Connie Willis here on Coast to Coast AM. You can find me on my show, Blue Rock Talk, Earth's Most Interesting Conversations, People, Places, and Things. Great conversation, a lot of fun, a community known as Blue Rockers, people that are in the know. And you can join me for free right now. My interactive website is actually free right now still at bluerocktalk.com. So you better get into it then. Shows are our subscription, but the interactive website, bluerocktalk.com. Thank you guys for being a part of that. So see, Blue Rock is the earth, right? So I love all this stuff too. If you know anything about my past, you'll also know that I love the moon. I'm all about the moon. It's beautiful, you know, because I could see it. I could take the telescope as well as a kid and look up there and see the moon, or just look up at it with my eyes. You know, there were wonderful things that happened just from what the moon looked like. If something wonderful did happen, I could look up at the moon and it happened on a full moon. If something wonderful happened, I can go, oh, wow, looked, it happened on the night where it was a crescent, where it was looked like the fingernail or the smile. So I kind of gauged things like that as a child. So I loved the moon. I just was, oh, and when I lived in an area outside of Sarasota, Florida, Longboat Key, Siesta Key, known as like the whitest sands anywhere and softest. Well, I would sit there in the middle of the night. I'd be about the, oh, seriously, this is true, sitting out there at night. And if you know that area at all, it's very seasonal. There's snowbirds, and then so they're there, and it's like crazy, and then they're not, and it's pretty empty. But you sit out there at night, and you can be the only one for months. But the white sands with the moon shining on, the reflection from the moon on the sand, that light, it just, you could look at it and think the sands, because they were so white, were, it was just like snow. But you could also look at it and go, wow, this is probably what it's like to be on the moon because it's so white. So I've always loved this too. So it's great to be able to talk to Dr. Robert Zubrin today or tonight, and hear that he has that same kind of love as well for space and the moon and getting out there and to Mars. And so Robert, it is very nice to talk to you. Let me ask you some questions, you know, that I just have myself. I guess I have been interspersing them as well. But what is the moon? What is it to us? And why the other planets have them too? You know, some of them have a whole bunch. What is the moon? What's it about?
Well, the moon is the Earth's eighth continent. It's got a surface area the size of Africa, and it's the closest world we can go to. So there's an argument to be made that it should be our first stop in our expansion into space, or conceivably we could go to Mars first, but right now it appears that the target is the moon, and from there we go further. But it's the first step in the transformation of humanity into a multi-planet space-faring species with the whole universe open to us.
The eighth continent. Never heard of that. That's excellent. Wow, get you thinking. You've got me thinking tonight, Robert. I like this. The eighth continent. I never heard of that. I like that. The eighth, maybe it's the ninth wonder of the world.
Right. Well, it is one of the wonders of the world, that's for sure. But it is, it's our eighth continent. It's the surface of the moon is equal in size to Africa. The surface of Mars is equal to all the continents of the Earth put together.
Wow. Oof. Amazing. Okay, so you say we could be there in 10 years, right?
We could be on Mars in 10 years. We should be on the moon in 5. It only took us 8 years to get to the moon the first time. And we were starting, you know, with 1961. We didn't even have push-button telephones then, let alone cell phones, let alone smartphones.
So I'm going to ask you a few things. I know that you don't like this area, and you can just give one-word answers. That's fine. But I want to make the people out there happy that these questions have been asked for you. And I know they're going to be quick answers. I get it. Were we ever on the moon before and told to be run off? Were we told to get out of here?
We were certainly on the moon before. We We landed on the moon with 6 Apollo missions. I know.
Were we told to leave?
Well, told to leave? No. Okay. We were made to leave by the Nixon administration.
Okay. Okay. Were any of the moon landings faked?
No. They were real. Sometimes I wonder, because I look at the NASA we have now and I say, these guys never could have gone to the moon. But it was a different NASA. And I think we can have that NASA again. But what's needed is serious marching orders. What's needed is, you know, I mean, if they got serious marching orders, then the deadwood get pushed out, actually, as they were the last time. I mean, you know, NASA was a descendant of a previous organization, which was a National Aeronautic Committee, and it had gotten pretty sleepy by that time. And not all of the NASA wanted to go to the moon, but Kennedy made it clear that that was going to happen. And what happened then was the can-do people rose to the top and the can't-do people got shown the door. And so the way to reform NASA is to push it into action. You know, it's like a peacetime military whose brass gets infested with the, doorknob polishers, and but then you get attacked and you're thrown into action, and ability shows itself and lack of ability shows itself, and you get rid of your McClellans and you bring in your Grants, and that's what we need to do with NASA.
Do you think that when Challenger, what happened there, they really slowed things down and stopped things?
Well,
or no?
Challenger explosion. Well, I think that was traumatic for NASA. But, NASA was selling the shuttle like it was a joyride. And even the name shuttle makes it sound like it's a routine thing. And it wasn't. It was a bold, dangerous ship of exploration. And if you're going to do this, you have to expect accidents. You have to expect there'll be casualties. If you insist that you're not going to go to Mars until it's safe, you're never going. Lindbergh flew the Atlantic, it wasn't safe the first time. Air travel became safe by doing it.
Yeah, any slowing down like that, I would think, this is just my thought, but I think everybody in the Challenger would have said, no, don't slow down, you keep going. Why? That's what we were doing, you keep going. I would think that they would say the same thing because of who they were.
That's what they said. Obviously the people who died didn't say anything, but I on one occasion did speak to Krista McAuliffe. She was the teacher on the Challenger. I spoke to her mother, and she said, don't stop. If you stop, you're betraying everything they gave their lives for.
Absolutely. I absolutely agree to that. And they all knew what they were getting into, and it was a terrible thing. I lived in Florida at the time, and I was watching, well, not at that time, but I saw many shuttles go up and other rockets not make it, and some things come down. You know, it was so incredible to be at those events, because you knew it was just history being made every time, whether something landed or went up or did even blow up. It was just wow to be there at Cape Canaveral. Oh man. Anyway, I'll tell you what, when you went at night and you saw that shuttle shoot up at night and you saw everything just turn into day as it went up, and then as you saw it go higher and higher and higher and then turn into what looked like another star in the sky, it just made you wonder what else is out there. And I love that. That's what I love about all of this. It makes you stop thinking and being mad politically and angry at somebody and this and that and screaming and yelling that you get so much of in everyday life if you just turn on that TV. And it's just so nice to have people get into their minds and wonder again of what's out there. You know, when you were a kid looking up at the sky.
Mm-hmm. Sure. It brings out the best in us.
I think so, too. So it's good to have you as an advocate with this. Appreciate that. So wait a minute, I got a couple other more of those regular questions I had to ask you. It's interesting to hear what you say, too. So, all right, what do you say to flat earthers?
They're wrong.
Okay, and that's it. And I did say it. You can say it in just a word or two.
Yeah.
I love the pictures of the of Earth from, I don't know, golly, I can't remember which ones they got those wonderful, beautiful Earth shots, but the Earthrise too. Oh, love it, love it, love it. And it just keeps on coming. And
yeah.
I love
now,
all the stories of space.
Okay, people say that shows a lot about the Earth, that there's mm-hmm. no borders and all of that, that those are artificial imaginary lines and they shouldn't divide us. And that's true too, but it shows us something else. The Earth is in space. We are part of space.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? We are not separate from space. We are in space. We're part of a universe, okay, which is filled with planets and probably filled with life. But whatever it is, we need to find out about it because the universe is our home.
Mm-hmm. I like it. Okay. All right. So let's go back to another question. And this one's kind of for me. This one's kind of for me. Now, I do believe there is life outside of here, that not just microbes, but real intelligent life. I do as well believe that they have visited. So I'm curious about this. I'm trying to figure out the best way to word it. But I believe I've heard many, many stories from what I believe are very credible sources about transfer technology where they have found and not just communication with aliens, but just found ships that they believe were from something else, someone else, not humans, and they were crashed or they were shot down, whatever. And then they took that and had this, you know, transfer technology to all of a sudden we went leaps and bounds, making things smaller, easier to get out there in space. What do you think of that? Do you think there's anything to
well,
that?
I haven't seen any evidence of that, but let me tell you something else. Okay, if I were aliens, the thing, you know, people are looking for messages from aliens and radio messages. I don't think that that is how you would send information across space.
Agreed.
I think you would send it in the form of DNA.
Ooh.
And the message wouldn't be, hello, here's the plans for building starships. No, the message would be like us. In other words, what are the kind of messages that people send to people they don't know? It's propaganda. Okay, think Radio Free Europe. Be like us. We are good. Be like us. Radio Moscow. We are good. Be like us. The Gideons leaving Bibles in hotel rooms. Join our faith. Okay? Be like us, become one of us. And so what's the equivalent of spreading Gideon Bibles across space? It's sending genes, okay? It would be entirely possible. We could do this ourselves right now. We could create little pellets with tiny cells on them that would be reflected, that would be pushed by sunlight, and they could be shot right out of our solar system to other solar systems, and they could contain microbes that carry our genes or genes of other terrestrial life forms or both entire Noah's arcs of genes and shoot them to other solar systems in order to spread our genes into their biosphere or even just start their biospheres and attempt to influence their evolution to be like us. Now, of course, once life got started anywhere or it would evolve in its own way. But think of a parent trying to influence the development of her child. So she leaves books around the house, hoping that the child will pick one up. And the child, okay, when it's a baby, might pick up letter blocks to play with. When it's 4 years old, it might pick up picture books. When it's 9 years old, it might pick up Harry Potter. When it's 16 years old, it might pick up Leo Tolstoy's War and Peace. Now, you are not making a duplicate of yourself by spreading your favorite books around the house, but you're influencing the development. The development occurs independent of you, but you can have some influence on it by leaving these this sort of information around the house. Now, imagine that there were extraterrestrials, and they wanted to help make life forms on other solar systems to be more like them. Well, the way to do that is by spreading your genes into it. Now, how could we know if this has happened? I'm not sure, but I think if we took this as a suspicion, and then we started looking at the genomes of terrestrial life forms to see if there was evidence of this sort of gene transfer. You know, bacteria can transfer genes from one organism to another. They do. They do that naturally. What if this was done intentionally? Well, I'm not saying that has happened, but I'm saying that if you're looking for extraterrestrials, the place to look for their messages is not in radio waves, but it's in the genes of life on Earth.
I can agree with that. That makes no sense, Theo. That was wonderful. Wonderfully said, wonderfully thought about as well.
Yeah, I talk about this in the book, The Case for Space. Discuss it. I'm also going to discuss it at a big conference in Berkeley next weekend as well.
All right, in Berkeley.
Genetic SETI.
Okay, all right. Yeah, I like that way better than the radio waves. I've never understood that. Oh, I just always thought that was a front for something else I didn't know. I'm like, that's not, who's going to do that? You know, radio? No, it's not going to happen. So, hey, those of you that are just now tuning in, you are listening to Coast AM. This is Connie Willis here, and I'm talking with Dr. Robert Zubrin, and very interesting stuff about space, space exploration, our plans, our ideas, our future, what we can do, what we can't do. And we've got a little bit more time with him, so I hope you stick around with me. And then after that, we'll be talking to an artist, Marcia K. Moore, and she brings back to life some old, dirty, scraggly, elongated heads. And it's amazing what she does, too. Stay with us. Connie Willis here on Coast to Coast AM. It's Coast to Coast AM. Connie Willis, one of the weekenders, fill-iners, very happy to be here, broadcasting from 850 KOA News Radio, Denver. I'm talking with Dr. Robert Zubrin, and he is really awakening the mind once again with all of his ideas and being an advocate of Mars and space exploration and colonizing. And it's great to talk with you. Thank you for being here with me tonight, Robert. So
thanks,
here's a question.
Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm having a ball here. Let me ask you this. It seems like to me, as we move off the planet and move out there in, you know, the final frontier, to me, just the beginning of it all, do you think humans, because we're not, you think we're getting dumber?
Do I think we're getting dumber? No, not as individuals. I think as society becomes bureaucratized, society collectively gets dumber. Bureaucracy is a form of artificial stupidity. It was actually invented for that purpose by, I think, Frederick the Great. In other words, when you first drilling soldiers to all march together this way, that way, just do it all at the same time, become a machine, and then have his government broken down so that this administrator is just doing this and only this, and you do it this way, and you don't make exceptions. And so everyone's motions are predictable. And, of course, the ultimate realization of that is the Holocaust, where no one's really responsible. I just drive this train. I just get people on the train. I just get people off the train. This has not, you know, don't blame me for what happens, okay, because no one's responsible. And as government everywhere are in one way or another emulating this model, it does create a form of collective stupidity. I call it artificial stupidity. People are worried about artificial intelligence. I'm worried about artificial stupidity.
Agreed. Agreed. I think, you know what, somebody asked me about AI recently, and are you afraid of it? And I thought, well, I mean, I don't think there's going to be any problems unless we program them incorrectly, because it's all about we program that intelligence, correct? So it's just bad guy that would program that in a bad way. I don't know that.
No,
I just don't see them taking over the world. That's all.
No, they're not. But they're just a tool. We invented labor-saving machinery to multiply the muscle power of people. And, you know, and to a certain extent, we have these things called robots. The most robots on the world today are industrial robots that basically perform assembly line tasks. And artificial intelligence is a way to multiply the number of skills a person has. That is, with the addition of artificial intelligence advising you, you might be able to fix your own car even though you're not an auto mechanic, and you might be able to do home remedies for your children without having to go to the doctor, because the diagnosis will be within the scope of your AI-augmented knowledge. Now, the one kind of robot that I am actually concerned about are not independent robots taking over the world for themselves, like in Terminator. I don't think that's ever going to happen. But I do think that robot soldiers in service to tyrants could make it very difficult to overthrow tyrants, because, you know, the ultimate test of when a tyrant can stay in power is when the troops are marching, when the people are marching on the palace. Do the troops fire on them, or do they join them? Well, since human soldiers are drawn from the people, at a certain point, they don't support the tyranny anymore. But a robot soldier could be something else entirely.
Mm. Well, there's another new movie. That sounds good.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, you have thought of these things. Well, tell me about how important Utah and the Arctic is to space exploration.
The Mars Society, which I lead, has practiced Mars exploration stations. We call them Mars analog research stations, in the Canadian High Arctic and in the American desert in Utah. And we send crews there, usually of six people, and we task them to conduct a sustained program of field exploration for a couple of weeks or perhaps even a couple of months while operating as if they're on Mars. So, for instance, they can't go outside without wearing spacesuits, and they have to do all their field exploration that way. And they have to do their lab work in the hab and engage in a telescience collaboration with our remote science team that's off the base. And by going through this exercise, you start learning what's likely to work on Mars and what you're likely to be able to do on Mars. And, in fact, at the Utah station, one of our crews exploring in spacesuits actually discovered some dinosaur fossils that, when followed up by professional paleontologists, because we reported the find to the authorities and gave the coordinates,
it has proven
to be the largest find of dinosaur fossils in North America in decades. It's as significant to find as Dinosaur National Monument. And I have to tell you, since I was actually there that day, that no robotic rover could have found those fossils. It could have even gotten to where the fossils were to be found, because it involved climbing down a 2-meter drop to get into this little box canyon, and then picking them out from the geological confusion of piles of rocks and stuff that were there. No rover could have done it. And so, you know, if we're going to want to find the fossils of past life on Mars, we're really going to have to go ourselves.
That must have been awesome to be there for that.
Yeah, it was. It was quite awesome, and it remains awesome. And it remains a very solid proof of why you need to send human explorers to Mars. You know, the Rockies here, Colorado, it's, you know, fossils are fairly prevalent. But you could parachute 100 rovers into the Rockies. You'd never find a dinosaur fossil. It takes, you know, rock hounds to find them.
Yeah, that makes sense. What do you think when, like, I was in Moab recently and checking in Utah and looking at some just beautiful, I mean, golly, it's just amazing. Never even knew that world existed the way it looks. It's amazing. And I saw a lot of rock art and some that had been sectioned off where it had some sort of, you know, marker of we know this is here and do not mess with it, but saw some other stuff that wasn't marked off. And it looks like, you know, little spacecrafts coming down and things like that. What do you think when you see those types of things? What are your thoughts when you see that? Because to everybody else, it's like, okay, people a long time ago are seeing these things coming from the sky, and that's why they're drawing it. So what do you think when you see that?
Well, It's hard to interpret what they saw. I will tell you that we actually made an interesting, not the Mars Society, but scientists made an interesting discovery last year, which was that the biblical city of Sodom was destroyed by a meteor. We have found the remnants of the meteor. That is, what was recorded in the Bible was an actual meteor strike that destroyed the city of Sodom. So records of ancient peoples, you know, that you might think, well, this is just a religious stuff or it's a myth. Well, it really happened, but it was an extraterrestrial strike. It was a meteor hitting it, and we know this is now a fact. I don't know about aliens, but ancient people certainly have visited, seen asteroid strikes, and, you know, and suffered from them. In fact, here's a piece of news people might not know. We had an asteroid land in the Bering Sea December 18th of last year, and it hit with a force 10 times that of the Hiroshima bomb. Mm. And this is why another reason why we have to become spacefaring. And I talk about this in our book, in the book, The Case for Space. It's for our survival. Our true environment is not the Earth. It is, at a minimum, the solar system. And there are rocks flying around. And if we don't become spacefaring, we will not have the ability to deflect these rocks. If we do, then we will be able to do them. And, Carl Sagan, who I knew, used to say all species either become spacefaring or extinct, because this stuff is out there and it's flying around. And, something with 10 times Hiroshima is actually a relatively small asteroid. It's a very small asteroid. Much bigger ones are out there. And we have to become a spacefaring species if we're going to get control of this.
Yeah, even more interesting as well in that conversation is what someone had taught me at one point. They said, you know, it's not all that hard of a thing to move these things out of our way to hurt us. As long as we can spot them and know they're coming, we just really have to nudge them a little and they go a whole different way.
You have to do it in deep space.
Okay? Yeah.
The closer it is, the harder it is. In other words, you know, look, if somebody is shooting a rifle at a target 300 yards away, if you just jar his aim a little bit, he'll miss the target. Mm-hmm. But if he's 3 feet from you, you have to hit the barrel with more force than he's holding it. And he might not be able to do it. And in the case of these asteroids, which are massive objects, we have to be able to do this in deep space.
Yeah.
So we need to be spacefarers.
Yeah. Absolutely. Real quick, a couple more of the questions that have come in. What do you think of Roswell?
Roswell, it's an interesting thing. I think I know what really happened there, which is that it was a test of a reconnaissance balloon. The United States in the late 40s and in the 1950s was developing reconnaissance balloons for flying over the Soviet Union and taking photographs of them, which was illegal under international law, but we needed to do it. And so what happened, well, first of all, there were tests and some of them came down, but also there were tests that were done where some civilians, farmers or someone, observed these glowing things moving in the sky. So I think I saw a huge balloon flying over here. And then what happened was the Air Force took responsibility to weird them out by having Air Force pilots report these things as flying saucers. And so it moved from, sightings that needed to be investigators to spooky stuff. And there's actually a book called Project Moby Dick about this program, in which discusses this, not so much in connection with Roswell, but other UFO sightings. And that is why, by the way, of the top UFO sightings, they're all done by U.S. Air Force pilots. They're not done by Navy pilots. They're not done by civilian pilots. They're There's a clear institutional bias in the data, and that shows that it was an organized cover-up of an actual reconnaissance program.
Well, you know, there's some other people I would have thought that would have thought differently, that actually believe in life, that is visiting here, and they agree with what you just said. And me, I'm still going to disagree with it, but that's fine. So tell me what you think about Bob Lazar.
Tell me a little more. Bob Lazar, what does he say?
Oh, okay. Oh, well, he's all about the transfer technology in Area 51. Never heard of him?
Well, I've certainly heard of Area 51. In fact, I've been to Area 51.
But Bob Lazar, you never heard of Bob Lazar?
I'm not familiar with him, no.
Okay.
Well,
that would give your answer.
but I can tell you something about Area 51 that I think people need to know.
Oh, please say real quick before we go, please.
Thank you. The real secret of Area 51 is there are 3,000 people working there on the government payroll, and they don't do anything.
They don't do anything?
No, they don't do anything. Okay. They've got almost as many people working there as work at Jet Propulsion Lab, except these people don't do anything. And that is what happens at Area 51. And that's the real secret.
Wow, and they're getting paid okay and going in some really vehicles. So I want that gig. That sounds like a fun one. Hey,
well,
so we're talking.
Sounds boring to me.
I've been watching a show, Silicon Valley, and they do something similar to some of their people there. So anyway, this has been Dr. Robert Zubrin that we've been talking about. Robert, is there anything else you want to say before you head off?
Yeah, sure. As I said, I've got a new book coming out May 14th. It's available on Amazon now. It's called The Case for Space, and it talks about how the revolution in spaceflight is going to open up a future of unlimited possibilities in Earth orbit, on the moon, on Mars, the asteroids, the outer solar system, and out to the stars, and why we have to take advantage of this, you know, for the knowledge, for our survival, for the future. And I think people who are listening to the show will find it real interesting, and I hope they check it out.
Do you think that we are in trouble as humans on this planet?
I think the biggest risk we have, it isn't even from asteroids. It's from ourselves. It's from the belief that there's only so much to go around, and so we're going to have to fight each other for it. And the only question is, when should we do it? And sooner or later, this is the myth that caused the disasters of the 20th century, but it's not a true view of reality. There's plenty to go around because the Earth comes with an infinite sky.
Mm. And, you know, I do think we have to worry about ourselves, and I do think Mother Nature will take care of herself and get rid of us if we mess with her. But you know what? That means that we're gone if she does that, and that means we need to have an escape plan from ourselves for what we do.
Yeah, but as I say, we're not in danger of there being too many people. We're in danger from people who think there are too many people and want to get rid of some others. And if we realize that there's infinite resources available to us, if we just work together, okay, there'll be as much as needed to go around and more.
Mm-hmm. And how can we find you?
Well, first of all, the Mars Society has a website, which is at marssociety.org. We're going to have a conference at the University of Southern California, October 17th through 20th, and people can register for it and come and even submit abstracts and maybe present a paper there. And that's all at marssociety.org. And
excellent.
As I said, they can also find out more about what I got to say by getting the book, The Case for Space.
Case for Space, Dr. Robert Zubrin. Thank you so much, Robert. Nice talking to you. Wow, that was interesting stuff, wasn't it? Well, now we got some interesting visuals coming your way with Marcia K. Moore next here. Connie Willis, you're listening to Coast to Coast AM.